So the hymn today is Be Thou My Vision. Wow. Let's sing it.
No way, it's actually
a little bit of that. Because let's be fair, this is such a good part of this. Be Thou My Vision, O Lord of my heart. Not be all else to me, save that Thou art. Thou my best thought, by day or by night, waking or sleeping, Thy presence, my life. Be Thou my
See, I always read it after victory won, but I put after. But thy victory won makes sense too.
So the only thing with it is it eclipses. It's not going to be on the dashboard. I think it's going to be relays. I'm not sure what it is.
Yeah, like, I like that song. It's just
more of the same. But only when you're moving.
What?
Have you heard the clicking sound?
God bless you.
No, it sounds like a short signal. It literally happens all the time.
No, that's never happened. No, I've never heard of that.
I think you're just oblivious. Yeah. It happens. It's like constant.
No, did you just face when you said that?
It's you. No, it's definitely something.
No, I think it might just be all in your head.
No, it's.
I think Cameron put in a clicking device.
I looked it up. I'm not crazy. Other people have the issue.
Really?
Yeah.
And I haven't heard of it.
I think it's some
maybe
sort
it's
of
a range you can't get.
I'm not sure what it is.
That would make sense.
So I'm going to try to solve that. Cameron,
will
next time you're in the car, listen for your turn signals. And
what is that noise?
Oh, well, what
my dad in the attic?
Well, we have the cleansing law, of course.
No, they don't, you don't have
the. Hey,
don't
so have let's go over the hill.
I don't want it.
I'm listening, Steven.
Be thou my vision, O Lord of my heart. Not be all else to me, save that thou art. What's that mean?
I mean, like visions are.
Tell me where to go.
Outside of the reality that we see every
day. Tell me where to go. What? Be thou my vision. You know, show me the way.
Yeah. Be kind of be my guiding light. Yeah. O Lord of my heart, not be all else to me, save that thou art. Thou my best thought by day or by night, waking or sleeping, thy presence my light.
You're my best thought day and night, and whether I'm awake or sleeping, or your presence.
Presence is my light. Again, on the kind of the be my guiding light sort of idea. Yeah. Be thou my vision and thou my true word, I ever with thee and thou with me, Lord. All those thees and thous make it so difficult, right?
You are my wisdom, my true word, and the word I can trust you. You'll always be with me, I'll always be with you.
There you go. Thou my great father and I thy true son, thou in me dwelling and I with thee one. I particularly want to know about this. What does that mean?
Maybe it has something to do with he's a Gentile and he knows he's grafted in. He's been adopted as a child of God.
Interesting.
Maybe.
Good
that's
thought.
What I said, that's what I said, maybe.
Well, that's
maybe
a good thought. You're thinking?
Maybe he wants, you know, to accept Jesus' abundance. He sees Jesus in your place. Since Jesus is his son.
That's a good thought. Yeah, I don't know why. I just that phrase stood out to me. Why is he calling himself God's true son? The whole covered in Christ's righteousness thing versus anyway. Thou in me dwelling and I with thee one.
Father, you and I are one as I hope that they are one or whatever that is.
Well, yeah, what would be the biblical reference for thou in me dwelling?
Leah, your
fault
is in the Bible. No, I sent you first.
What is it? Two?
I don't know.
I sent
you first.
It wasn't
two. What are you referring to?
It's the Spirit coming upon them.
Okay, Spirit coming upon them in Pentecost, but playing devil's advocate.
In those exact words.
It doesn't actually say that God's Spirit dwells within them in that verse. Or in that chapter.
It's not candy.
It says that the Spirit comes upon them there.
That's not so wrong.
The only one I can
think
of is Galatians 2:20.
What's Galatians 2:20 say?
No longer I can live, but Christ lives within me. So
there you go. Okay, that'd be one.
It's not about the Spirit, but the Spirit specifically about Christ.
Yeah. I believe it's Romans 13. No, Romans. Maybe it's Romans 12. There's. Now I'm going to have to look it up. Just.
Read.
But I'm just an adult dummy, so you guys can have me dumb adults.
I'm an adult.
Yeah.
What?
I'm an adult. Yeah, that's
good.
I'm 18. Yes. But can you drink?
Depending on
if you're
not legally.
No, you can drink.
1 Corinthians 3:16.
1 Corinthians 3:16. Do you not know that you are a temple of God and that the Spirit of God dwells in you?
But is that talking about would y'all shut up? I'm trying to talk. Good grief.
Borrow what? Yeah. Would that be what?
Is that
the Spirit dwelling or Christ dwelling? Or does it matter?
That would be the Spirit. There's another one that says...
Well, I know that the one that you just said was the Spirit dwelling, but the one that Jericho said was Christ.
It was Christ, yeah. And
I was just saying, that's the only one that comes to mind for me. I didn't know any others, but I didn't know if it would be applicable to you if it is Christ specifically in that verse.
There's one that I thought it was in Romans. Romans 8. It was Romans. 8 through 11. You, however, are not in the realm of the flesh, but in the realm of the Spirit, if indeed the Spirit of God lives in you. And if anyone does not have the Spirit of Christ, they do not belong to Christ. He goes back and forth between using the Spirit of God and Spirit of Christ. But if Christ is in you, then even though your body is subject to death because of sin, the Spirit gives life because of righteousness. And if the Spirit of Him who raised Jesus from the dead is living in you, He who raised Christ from the dead will also give life to your mortal bodies because of His Spirit who lives in you. So, Romans 8, verses 9 through 11, he's like blurring the lines between the Spirit of Christ and the Spirit of God, and he goes back and forth between those two terms. And it messes with my theology all over the place, and I haven't figured out how to sort that out. Yeah. Problems with me, not with the text, obviously.
But
so, Romans 8, verses 9 through 11 are the ones that would say Spirit of Christ lives in you and Spirit of God is the same thing as the Spirit of Christ. We'll get off of that now, because
it's making you nervous.
Be thou my battle shield, sword for the fight. Be thou my dignity, thou my delight. This is the verse that nobody knows.
Yeah, I've never heard this verse ever in my life. It's been around a long time.
I mean, there's going to be a lot of people who try to tear you down. So, I mean, your pride, your sense of being isn't within other people's...
Nice.
Your significance is in Christ. Battle shield, like the sword of the Spirit, the gospel of...
Hey, there you go, thinking along Ephesians 6 lines.
Yes.
Thou my soul's shelter, thou my high tower, raise thou me heavenward, O power of my power. Translation?
I mean, it's a place to escape to, a place to be at peace, I guess.
There you go.
Well, for the third line, there's many different psalms that David talks about. You are my shelter. You are my hiding place. My strong tower.
You are my strong tower. Yeah.
I just run into you, and then you
raise thou me heavenward. To what is he referring?
Stop it.
So there's one option.
I can go that's like taking home or.
Yeah, so there's a couple different options within the semantic domain, right? Of this phrase, raise thou me heavenward. Does that mean kill me? Like, take me up? Take me now, Jesus? Or does that mean make me more holy? Make me more Christ-like? I would opt for the second option, considering the context of the verse. But... Riches I heed not, nor man's empty praise. Thou mine inheritance now and always. Thou and thou only, first in my heart, high King of heaven, my treasure thou art.
I don't need riches or empty praise.
Because you are my treasure.
You're my dignity.
Right. You're all I need. Yeah, good. And last one, high King of heaven. Thy victory won, aft victory won. May I reach heaven's joys, O bright heaven's sun. Heart of my own heart, whatever befall, still be my vision, O ruler of all.
Jesus Christ, take away our sins.
Yeah, to what victory is he referring?
The victory.
The day of the Lord.
The day of the Lord. Oh, nice reference to our prophets that we've been studying. Which refers to what event? Second Camp Coming. There you go.
So, O Bright Heaven's Son, that could also be S-O-N.
Could also be S-O-N. Still,
and it's capitalized. Why would it be capitalized if it weren't supposed to be S-O-N?
Yeah, there you go. So,
it is referring really important to the radiance of the sun.
Right, I get that.
Because, yeah, well, it's clearly a It's a title. It's a title or a name. And actually, we'll mention that in the first paragraph of the meaning of the hymn. So if you want to read along with me. This 8th century anonymous hymn, so it's from the 700s. 8th century anonymous Irish hymn text expresses, in the quaint Celtic style, the ageless need of man to have a heavenly vision and to experience God's care and personal presence throughout this earthly pilgrimage. The author's high regard for God is evident in various titles ascribed to him. Vision, Lord, Best Thought, Wisdom, Word, Great Father, High King, Inheritance, Treasure, Son, Ruler, and Heart. So that would be the wise son capitalized. Well, it's one of the many titles that the author was using throughout the whole song to refer to God himself. Mary Byrne's translation of this ancient Irish poem into English prose first appeared in the journal Erin, volume 2, published in 1905. Later, the prose was put into verse form by Eleanor H. Hull and published in her Poem Book of the Gael, 1912. The tune, Slane, is a traditional Irish air from Patrick W. Joyce's collection Old Irish Folk Music and Songs, published in 1909. The tune was originally used with a secular text, With My Love on the Road. Its first association with this hymn text was the Irish Church Hymnal of 1919. This is the part that I find the most interesting thing about this hymn. The tune is named for a hill 10 miles from Tara in Count Meath, where St. Patrick is said to have challenged King Leolair and the druid priests, by lighting the paschal fire on Easter Eve. Although the melody has been harmonized by various musicians, it is generally recommended that his tune is the most effective when sung in unison. Should be this tune.
Did you find a snake earlier?
No.
You find a what?
Every St. Patrick's Day, I want to eat snake, because I want this to catch on as a St. Patrick's Day tradition, because as legend goes, St. Patrick chased all the snakes out of Ireland. So I'd like to have some way of celebrating St. Patrick's Day that is more related to the actual St. Patrick, as opposed to just getting drunk and drinking green beer, yeah. So, you know, I think that'd be cool if we all went and grilled snakes for St. Patrick's Day.
Snake is, what is that place? It's that
the only place in Texas, in Houston, where I found that actually serves snake is Sammy's Wild Game Grill, and they just do a python stew. And I want, like, a piece of snake that I can eat with a fork and knife.
You should call them and ask if you can get some of the python before they
stew. Explain what you're doing and say, I would like to tell you. Let's get this going.
Or ask for their snake dealer.
Or buy a snake and then kill it.
That'd be the most expensive way to go about this.
Yes.
Or
anyway.
Buy a snake.
You
can
just put a wild game trap out there with some snake baby.
Yeah, and there are wild game sellers. I just keep forgetting whenever St. Patrick's Day comes around until it's too late for me to actually get some in time for St. Patrick's Day. So I need to remember.
Now?
It's like a week and a half away.
You should just dock one snake.
It's, I just always have snake on hand.
Wait, is it? It's that close?
Yeah.
Yeah, today's the 4th.
So you're trying to get this to catch on, or is it just for you?
Hmm?
Are you trying to get this to catch on, or is it just for you?
I want it to catch on, yeah.
Good luck.
I think it's a great idea. Just like I want to have an actual Valentine's Day celebration that's about celebrating the memory of St. Valentine and teaching about Christian marriage, which is what Valentine's Day is all about, instead of about premarital sex and chocolate hearts.
Didn't he have his head cut off?
Yeah, he was beheaded for continuing to perform Christian marriages when Caesar told him not to.
I thought there was something about a beheading in there somewhere, so we could join that into the practice somehow.
Yeah.
So beheaded chocolate bear.
So anyway, the tune for this hymn is called Slane, in reference to a hill that St. Patrick supposedly lit the paschal fire on Easter Eve when he was combating the druids and kind of Christianizing Ireland. It was quite scandalous for him to do so, because nobody was supposed to light any fires on that day except for the king's fire. So that's why it's a remembered thing.
Okay. reminds me of the Elijah up on the hill against his prophets.
Yeah. Where were we? Fourth
Mary
grade.
Mary Elizabeth Byrne.
Mary Elizabeth Byrne was born in Dublin, Ireland in 1880. She received her education at the University of Dublin and became a research worker and writer for the Board of Intermediate Education in her hometown. One of her most important works was her contribution to the Old and Mid-Irish Dictionary and the Dictionary of the Irish Language. Eleanor H. Hull was born in Manchester, England on January 15, 1860, and she was the founder and secretary of the Irish Texts Society and served as president of the Irish Literary Society in London. She authored several books on Irish history and literature. Yes?
I thought you talked there
someday. In an Irish accent? I could, but I won't.
So, why would someone, unless like someone, like it was somehow in her ancestry or whatever, like the Eleanor lady? I mean, she's English, so why does she really care about Irish so much? I wonder.
She just really liked Irish literature.
I guess so.
Hey, Irish culture is
good. Yeah, or she's Irish. I mean, there's lots of Irish people living in England.
Right. And to be born in Manchester, that means she wouldn't be Irish.
Well, I mean, I'm Italian.
Is that it?
And it's a whole lot more over there. It doesn't quite matter as much where you were born as what your family is.
I don't. Okay, so another thing. Sorry, I'm just being very picky.
Yeah.
Okay, the first line, this 8th century anonymous Irish text expresses in the quaint Celtic style. Quaint. Why is this quaint Celtic style?
I have to ask Kenneth Osbeck.
I know, that just drives me nuts, Mr. Kenneth Osbeck. You're driving me nuts.
Well, also, I mean, realize that the tune isn't quite. I mean, it's been sung for over a century now. I think the reference to quaint Celtic style actually refers to the meter of the poem. It's a Celtic poem, so it follows a particular.
So quaint, not as cute,
yeah.
Whatever, but quaint is in the descriptive
of the
poem,
yeah.
Whatever.
Day is March.
Actually, it's not jazz.
What?
It's
unfortunate. You're gonna want a Bible out and last week's notes out.
Yes, I definitely know where
those
are right now.
I have a couple extra copies, I believe.
I would like one of those, please.
Sorry, that was
Jeremiah.
Accident.
Well, I got
what's
it?
It's
an eye. Children.
I don't have my stapler this week, though, so we have to take two loose papers and staple them yourself.
I can definitely do that.
Alright.
Just three copies.
There is one in the drawer. Go over and down.
Why? Just this one.
Tonight.
Someone scream in it?
Yes.
Friday night. A lot of people scream. They scream in it.
What was going on Friday night?
Does anybody need a copy last week?
We drove to Texarkana.
Cameron, how many are you needing?
Did anyone go to the camel ostrich races?
I haven't decided if I want to go again.
Camel ostrich races?
I've been to camel races, but...
Yeah, they had one.
Camel ostrich races.
Sam Houston.
Anybody need a pen? Pens, anyone? Pens?
I've been to real camel.
Sure.
We are in Zechariah. We're going to skip over Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, and Jonah because I think you guys know those pretty well. We'll pick up with Micah in our review.
My naked guy? Micah. He's the mini...
Micah, the naked guy, and the mini Isaiah. What else? Give me some of the famous quotations from Micah.
Bethlehem. Is that him?
That's him. What's the full quotation?
Jesus,
where are we going?
What does it say that?
Bethlehem. It's the full quote. Where are we going?
I don't remember.
For you, Bethlehem Ephrathah will be
will not be counted the least among the cities of Jerusalem.
That one.
Of Judah.
I just remember Ephrathah because it's my name.
Cities of Judah. For from you will come a ruler. Jesus. Yeah.
Weren't there two Bethlehems and they had to differentiate Bethlehem and Ephrathah from the other?
Yep.
Which one?
Okay, so yeah, Micah, mini Isaiah, quotations concerning the Messiah will beat your plasma swords, beat your swords into plowshares, your spears into pruning hooks.
See the guy that came, the quotation from out of Egypt?
That's Hosea. But good to remember New Testament quotations of prophets, hint, hint. There might be money on the line. Hint, hint.
Quotations, what?
New Testament quotations of prophets.
He's already started Jeopardy.
Jeopardy?
This
Jeopardy.
Who's next? Jonah, Micah?
No.
Nahum? Tell me about Nahum.
Destruction of Nineveh.
Destruction of Nineveh. What's Nineveh mean?
City of fish.
City of fish, yes. Nice.
And he was actually representing Judah.
No.
That's Jonah.
Yes, I heard Nineveh. I was assuming you're talking about Jonah, so.
What else about Nahum? Anything stick out?
Anyway. It talks about the uprising of the Babylonians.
It does, yeah.
And it's supposed to scare some people into fixing their ways.
Yeah. Playing. Nice rephrasing of the usual. Repent, judgment is coming. What about your guy that you always mention? King of Assyria?
Oh,
Ashurbanipal, yeah. He's mentioned in Nahum, not by name, but by reference. Jonah, Micah, Nahum.
Obadiah. I don't know.
Amos.
Habakkuk, yeah. Tell me about Habakkuk.
Justice. The hymnist.
The hymnist, yeah, he's the hymnist. He's
oh, there was
the psalmist. Yeah, there was. Chapter 3 is a psalm.
The rock that warned people that destruction was coming and they should leave.
Repent, judgment is coming.
Repent, judgment is coming. What do you mean, the rock that warned people?
He said, write it plainly on a rock. So
write it plainly on stone tablets. That's what I thought you were talking about. Okay, good, yeah. Yeah, good. And the New Testament quotation quoted 3 different times. Remember what books
it's Spirit,
quoted?
The Spirit,
is it the one about living by faith, or the righteous by faith?
The righteous will live by faith. What 3 books is it quoted in?
Is it Galatians?
Galatians?
I want to say
John.
Romans?
And possibly Acts?
It's one of the Gospels, right? I thought it was.
Give me a hint. It's a book that we don't know who wrote it in the New Testament.
Hebrews,
yeah. Galatians, Romans, and Hebrews. Good. That's Habakkuk.
Romans,
and
Galatians, and Hebrews?
Actually, Paul wrote Galatians first, probably, so.
I'm just going by the
Yes, sure. And also, fun fact, he's my favorite prophet. He's my favorite minor prophet, at least. Habakkuk, Zephaniah. Tell me about Zephaniah.
He was a king.
Or
a descendant from a king.
Descendant from a king?
Hezekiah.
Descendant from King Hezekiah. Yeah, good. What else is unique about Zephaniah? How do we keep him straight?
I don't remember. Doesn't talk about everything else?
Yeah, he's like the conglomeration of the other minor prophets, right? He's got the section where he mimics Amos, dishing out judgment on surrounding nations. He's got the section about the day of the Lord, like Joel does. He's got the section referring to, what's the other major one? Micah, he's got a Christological section. Good, that's Zephaniah.
He's a distant cousin of Josiah.
Distant cousin of Josiah, yeah. Exactly. Descendant from King Hezekiah. Nice. And then we have that. Oh, yes. So great.
I know. It's just...
Marvel needs to call me up to do some of their CGI work. Okay.
What's that one movie that didn't do very well? Didn't Justice League use your animation?
Yeah. That's DC. That's I was all they could get. So, Zephaniah, who's the first prophet after the return? Say it louder, Leah.
Haggai.
Yeah. Haggai. What does he do? What's unique about him?
Rebuilding wall. Temple?
He's all about rebuilding the temple. Rebuilding the wall would be Nehemiah. All
right.
So he's all about rebuilding the temple, trying to get the guys to come together and build. And then he finishes up his thing with a quick messianic prophecy. What's that prophecy
something
about?
About some guy not being, sorry, being, his line would be blessed to have Jesus.
Zerubbabel.
Yeah, Zerubbabel will be a signet ring of the coming Messiah. Nice. And then, who we're on currently, Zechariah. The longest, most confusing prophet in the minor prophets. What? The priest prophet, right? So you had Zechariah, who's a priest, descended from a priestly line. And you have Zephaniah, who's a kingly line. So you have priest prophet and king prophet.
Isn't that the other way around?
Nope.
You just did it, like, backwards. Yeah.
Zechariah, what did we talk about last week?
Horses that roam the earth.
Oh, don't lie, Leah.
There were some horses involved.
There were some horses involved.
Some angels.
All right, so remember, Zechariah breaks down really neatly 8 symbolic visions, 4 explanatory messages, 2 oracles. 3 clear sections in Zechariah. And we got through 4 of the 8 visions. We got through chapter 3 last week.
Isn't that pretty much the only clear thing?
Yeah. The clearest part of the book is the division of chapters. Everything else is quite difficult to interpret. So yeah, we got through 4 of the 8. We had the rider in the red... that's right. The rider on the red horse and the other 2 horses standing among the myrtle trees, right, talking with the angel. Is this one? Yeah. We had the 4 horns and craftsmen, which I can't believe I didn't put that picture up here. And you had 4 horns, who were the rulers of the earth, and then 4 craftsmen who came in and were like, "Hey, we're gonna remake these horns," and made them unrecognizable, destroyed them, kind of. Yeah, didn't quite understand it.
Fear.
He had the man with the measuring line. What was he going off to do?
Measure Jerusalem.
He's going to go measure Jerusalem, and then what happens to him?
He stops him and says, "Hey, tell this guy."
Yeah, somebody else stops him and says, "Hey, you don't need to go measure Jerusalem, because why?"
Jerusalem will be inhabited without walls because of the multitude of people and livestock in it.
Exactly.
Wow.
God's going to dwell in their midst.
Also because and it's kind of pointless.
It'll be wallless. It'll be pointless. Yes? the last one we wrapped up with, Joshua and his clean clothes, right? The high priest Joshua is standing in front of an angel of the Lord. Satan is there accusing him, and what does the angel of the Lord say?
He does say words, yes. He says, "Take off the clothes, put on clean clothes,
and what does Zechariah say after he gets the clean clothes? Zechariah says, "Put a clean turban on him." Good.
Who is it?
Joshua,
the high priest. So yeah, who are the 2 big authorities in Israel at this time? Joshua, the high priest, is one of them. Who's the other one?
The king.
Governor would be more accurate. His name?
Is it some sort of Herod?
No.
Okay.
It's Zerubbabel. Okay. Yeah, there's Zerubbabel and Joshua, who are kind of the 2 authorities right now, church and state. And if you remember, I've used this phrase a couple times in here, I think. Prophet, priest, and king. Those are kind of the 3 offices that leaders in Israel fill, right? Moses fulfills the role of prophet and king, sort of. Aaron was priest. As you get into the divided kingdom, you have prophet, priest, and king. High priest, prophets who are speaking to the king. These are the 3 offices. And so, at this time, Haggai and Zechariah are acting as prophets. Zerubbabel is acting as king, governor, because they're under Persian rule at this time. And then Joshua is acting as high priest. So they're kind of back into proper Israel functioning order.
So when you're saying prophet, you're talking about Zechariah as the prophet in this case.
Exactly, yeah. And we talked about in that vision, you have the I will bring my servant to the branch, clear messianic prophecy, right? So, stone with seven eyes. The only other time the phrase with seven eyes is used is Revelation, when we're talking about the lamb slain with seven eyes. Clearly Jesus in that context. So, had that link there. And that was the fourth vision. So, we're going to look at the second four visions, the last four visions, and then we're going to get into the I'm forgetting what my outline is now. Not the two oracles, that's last. The four explanatory messages. That's right. Everybody with me?
Yes.
Check it out. We're going to dive in.
Let's pray.
Yes, you're right. Thank you.
Good thought, Nathan. I'm so glad you're here.
I thought about it while we were singing, and I just forgot.
All right. Thank you, Nathan, for that reminder. By the way, anytime I forget prayer, just stop me, because that's one of my weaknesses that I'm prone to. All right. Vision number five. Golden lampstands and two olive trees. This one I understand a little bit better. So we are in Zechariah chapter 4. And the angel who talked with me, so remember, Zechariah is talking with one angel who's kind of showing him all of these visions. The angel who talked with me came again and woke me like a man who is awakened out of his sleep. Because that's how you normally wake someone. And he said to me, "What do you see?" I said, "I see, and behold, a lampstand all of gold, with a bowl on the top of it and seven lamps on it, and with seven lips on each of the lamps that are on the top of it. And there are two olive trees by it, one on the right of the bowl and one on the other, on its left." And I said to the angel who was talking with me, "What are these, my lord?" And the angel who talked with me answered and said to me, "Do you not know what these are?" I said, "No, my lord." That's why I asked. Then he said to me, "This is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel. Not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts. Who are you, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel you shall become a plain, and he shall bring forward the top stone amid shouts of grace, grace to it." Let's pause there. Let's get it up clearly in our heads. What did he see? What was the picture? And then we'll talk about what does it represent.
A gold lampstand and two olive trees.
So a gold lampstand and two olive trees. Describe the lampstand to me.
Mine says candlestick with a receptacle at the top and seven lamps with 14 pipes going to the lamps. Yours said something else.
Mine says about belonging.
Mine says seven pipes with seven lamps.
Let me see your Bible with its translation notes. Oil by pipes, a large basin top of the menorah. From this basin, two pipes extend to each of the seven lamps on the menorah for a total of 14 pipes. I don't know. I'm going to have to read it in Hebrew. Woo! This is...
Yep. He can also read Greek.
Also, Max, something you should know, Stephen is an errant. So...
Without air.
Yeah. I thought he was full of pot.
That's more accurate.
No, it's colder. He's a little more dense. That's a quote. In air. Steven is in air.
Oh, I'm too tired for this.
That was an accident. I was no, I don't trust you to touch my meat anymore. No, you deserve.
You did throw pillows at her.
That was an accident. I had to go to the bathroom.
An accidental lift.
Seven.
Brownie crumbs.
Don't forget
to save. Hey, save some crumbs.
Okay, so I see how they got to the two coming from each of 14. So you see how it says seven twice. The word I'm highlighting here, Shiva. So the seven to her seven. The seven. So are we talking about the original seven, or are we talking about two sets of seven pipes? That's how they got to the 14. So a little bit confusing on that. Yeah, I prefer the ESV that there's seven spouts coming up from the seven lamps, one for each lamp. But that'd be a translation. It looks something like this. So you got the bowl and the pipes going to each of the lamps.
Unless there's 14 pipes in there, it'd be 14.
What?
And those little tiny spouts, it's not coming off.
Yeah, those are the pipes going to light the lamp, right?
Well, so the fire is all offset.
We literally just talked about that.
That's really?
Yeah.
Shut up!
And then you got two olive trees, and the olive trees are producing oil that are going into the bowl, right?
Okay, because it's in oil lamps.
Exactly. Olive oil would be what you burn in the lamps to keep them lit. So the idea being, these olive trees are always producing oil, the lamp is always staying lit. You with me? So I'm going to read it again so you have this picture in your mind.
That's lit, man.
I said, I see, behold, a lampstand all of gold with a bowl on the top of it and seven lamps on it with seven lips on each of the lamps that are on top of it. And there are two olive trees by it and on the right of the bowl and on the other on its left. The olive trees going into the bowl. I said, what are these? He said, do you not know? No, I don't. He answered me, this is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel. Not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts. So what is the message to Zerubbabel?
Two trees and an oil lamp.
Oh, well, what did he specifically just say? This is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel. What is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel?
Not by might, not nor by power, but by my spirit.
Not by might nor by power, but by my spirit.
Is that how that picture is explained?
Yeah.
Not by my power, but by my spirit.
Yeah, we're gonna get there because we've only read half of the vision so far. So. Baby, with me. So this vision is somehow a message to Zerubbabel saying, not by your power, not by your might, but how is Zerubbabel going to do anything?
By God.
By God, by my spirit. He shall bring forward over the top stone and shouts of it, grace, grace. The top stone, or some what might translate the
capstone.
Yeah, ring any bells?
Jesus.
Yeah.
Is the capstone or cornerstone?
Exactly. So, point being, Zerubbabel, you're not going to lead the nation by yourself. The whole point of you leading the nation, the whole point of Israel being together, is that the capstone might be brought forward with shouts of
grace
to it. It's all about grace. We got the gospel right here in Zechariah. Big surprise.
So the tree and the menorah haven't come in yet.
The whole vision is giving this message. So, but he continues, so we're going to read the rest of the vision. So verse 8, this is new material. The word of the Lord came to me saying, the hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of his house. His hands shall also complete it. Then you will know that the Lord of hosts has sent me to you. For whoever has despised the day of small things shall rejoice and shall see the plumb line in the hand of Zerubbabel. These seven are the eyes of the Lord, which range through the whole earth. Then I said to him, what are the two olive trees on the right and on the left of the lampstand? And a second time I answered and said, what are these two branches of the olive trees which are beside the two golden lamps, from which the golden oil is poured out? He said to me, do you not know what these are? I said, no, my Lord. Then he said to me, these are the two anointed ones who stand by the Lord of the whole earth.
Seven eyes.
So, the seven lampstands are the what?
Seven eyes.
Seven eyes of what?
Sevenfold spirit.
The eyes
yes.
of the Lord, which constantly reigns.
Is that what your translation said, though? These seven are the sevenfold spirit?
I think it says somewhere, either in this one or something, it says sevenfold spirit. Instead of seven spirits.
You know why it's in parentheses here?
Mine just says the eyes of the Lord.
Yeah.
Well, mine doesn't say that here, but in Revelation it
okay, gotcha.
Sevenfold spirit.
Yeah, alright.
Sorry.
Gotcha, yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, you're on the right track. I just want to... Yes, that's where the kind of the connection all comes together. But the seven eyes of the Lord, which range through the whole earth, this links up with a psalm, a message in Isaiah that talk about sevenfold spirit of the Lord, and then Revelation, sevenfold spirit. Again, we have a picture of the seven lampstands that represent the spirit of God. So this is how we bring all these images together to get some sort of clarity here. All that linked with the initial interpretation of this message, which was Zerubbabel, not by your power, but by my spirit. So the seven lampstands are the spirit of the Lord, the eyes of the Lord here, giving power, fire. Right?
Is that why they have a menorah? Is that symbolic?
Yeah, so I would say the menorah is Christologically symbolic, yes.
Well,
as
I mean,
are
the,
all of the...
But this is why the Jews have the menorah, possibly?
Clarify like, what you mean.
Well, like, menorah is very characteristic. Like, no one else has anything like that except the Jews. And
yeah.
So I'm wondering if they didn't get the idea for the menorah, like some kind of symbolism of some sort from Zechariah.
It goes further back. So the menorah with seven lamps on it
mm-hmm.
is actually a piece of the tabernacle and temple furniture.
Okay.
You've got the lampstand on one side, the showbread on the other,
mm-hmm.
the wash basin in the middle inside the holy place.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say you can pretty much clearly show from the text both the lampstand and the showbread are Christ types. They are pointing to Jesus, the Messiah. I don't have time to work through showing all that, but easiest place to see that is I am the light of the world, the lampstand in the holy place. I am the bread of life coming down from heaven, showbread. This is Christ. These are all the whole point of everything in the tabernacle and the temple is pointing to Jesus. The actual menorah is just that's the lampstand that is in the temple.
What the directions
that God
gave them.
Correct.
Back in the day.
Yeah. So he's talking about the seven lampstand with seven things. They're like, oh yeah, okay, the temple lamp. Got it. Yeah. This is actually the golden menorah that the Temple Institute in Jerusalem plans to put back in the temple if they ever get to rebuild it. There's an institution that is currently lobbying to try and get the rights to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem, and they have this thing built, ready to go, on display. You can go see it in Jerusalem. I took a picture of it when I was there, but it didn't turn out this nice, so I ripped one from the internet instead. It's pretty cool, because if you believe like I do,
like
it's actually going to get rebuilt, and it's actually going to be put back in use, and then the Antichrist will come and cease the sacrificial system. The abomination of desolation of the people who of the prince who is to come. Yeah. So, we're clear on what the lampstand is, right? The sevenfold spirit of God, giving power to Zerubbabel to lead, pointing towards the Messiah who's going to come shouting grace, grace to it. Yes. What about the two olive trees? Verse 11, I said to him, what are these two olive trees that on the right and on the left of the lampstand? what are these two branches of the olive trees, which are beside the two golden pipes? He said to me, don't you know? I said, no, my lord. And he says, this is what he says. These are the two anointed, or more literally, these are the two sons of new oil. So, anointed, you anoint with oil. So, these are the two anointed with oil. Who stand by the Lord on the whole earth. So, think with me. Start with context of Zechariah. Who might he be talking about? Two anointed people.
The high priest.
The high priest and?
And the king.
The king, or the governor. So, Zerubbabel, Joshua. That's what the two last messages were, right? Vision of Joshua getting the new clothes and the turban, and then a vision for Zerubbabel about leading, your power will be by the Spirit. So that's a very common interpretation of this, that the two olive trees are Zerubbabel and Joshua, high priest and governor of Israel at the time. Who else might they be? Think broader than Zechariah now.
Because of the imagery of the sevenfold spirit and stuff that goes to Revelation.
Points to Revelation, yeah.
I thought of the two saints who are left that are like...
The two witnesses who are walking the streets of Jerusalem who get killed by the Antichrist and resurrected 3 days later in the streets for all to see.
Yes.
Yeah, so that would be another major one that people point to. Say, okay, we've got these two here, the two witnesses in Revelation. I believe it's Revelation 13. I might have the chapter wrong on that. Who else might it be?
God, Father, and Jesus Christ.
Okay. Interesting, yeah. So you got the Spirit represented by the menorah, the Father and the Son represented by the trees. Interesting. Hadn't thought of that. Something to dig on. I would tend to shy away from that just because it seems like he's talking about people.
Yeah, no, it's just...
These are the two sons of new oil who stand by the Lord of the Holy Earth. But it's a good thought. You're thinking right.
Chapter 11.
Okay. The other one that pops to mind, the two who stand by the Lord of the whole earth. Can you think of a time, maybe in the Gospels, when two anointed ones stand by the Lord of the whole earth? Shows up in a couple of the synoptic gospels. Jesus and takes Moses. Peter.
Moses and Elijah?
Moses and Elijah, Mount of Transfiguration, right?
But aren't those... Some people think those are the two witnesses.
Yeah, some people would say those are the two witnesses, yeah. Gee, maybe we're talking about the same thing with all three occurrences. Transfiguration, two witnesses, two anointed ones. Mm-hmm. Same thing. I don't know. don't have an answer to this question. I'm just giving you the major views because I haven't picked one yet. I'm not confident enough to say, yeah, I'm pretty sure of this one. I encourage you to study it yourself, and if you come up with a good argument for a particular view, let me know. All right, that's the fifth vision. Sixth vision. You got a flying scroll. Somebody want to read Chapter 5, verses 1 through 4.
Okay. I looked again, and there before me was a flying scroll. Exclamation point. He asked me, what do you see? I answered, I see a flying scroll 30 feet long and 15 feet wide. And he said to me, this is the curse that is going out over the whole land. For according to what it says on one side, every thief will be banished. And according to what it says on the other, everyone who swears falsely will be banished. The Lord Almighty declares, I will send it out, and it will enter the house of the thief and the house of him who swears falsely by my name. It will remain in his house and destroy it, both its timbers and its stones.
All right. So what do you see, first of all?
That it has a thing.
A giant scroll.
He saw a giant scroll.
On one side was curse for thieves, and the other side was a curse for those who swear falsely by it.
On one side you have a curse for thieves, the other side you have a curse for those who swear falsely by his name. It's 20 cubits by 10 cubits. A cubit is about a foot and a half. I'm just kidding. What were the two things on the sides one more time? Curse for?
Thief.
Thieves and?
Those who
Falsely swearing. Swearing by the name of the Lord.
Could that be taking the Lord's name in vain?
Yes. That's what I'm getting at. So, think with me. Where are those two things in the law, in the Ten Commandments? Mm-hmm. Two tablets of stone.
In the list of things not to do.
Yeah. They're actually the third and the eighth. So, three from the end of, on either side, halfway through the front five and the back five. You with me? So you got five commands in the middle on either side of this scroll are these, those who swear falsely and those who steal. Most interpreters, and I've come around to agree with them, this is a reference to the law, the whole law. It's like a poetic way of summing up the heart of either side of the tablets of stone that Moses carved, or that God carved on for Moses.
So basically anyone who sins.
Yes. So I see a flying scroll. We're going to just go with me for now. That is, this is a representation of the law. This is a curse that goes out of the face of the whole land. For everyone who steals shall be cleaned out according to what is on one side, and everyone who swears falsely shall be cleaned out according to what is on the other side, and I will send it out, declares the Lord of hosts, and it shall enter the house of the thief and of him who swears falsely by my name, and it shall return, it shall remain in his house and consume it, both timbers and stone. So what's going to happen to those who swear falsely and who steal? Yeah. It's gonna ultimately eat it up. Now, question, I will send it out. What is he gonna send out? Yeah, right. It's kind of ugly. He's going to send the scroll out. What is the scroll?
Representing the law.
Judgment.
Judgment. Representing the law. Yeah. The law and judgment. The all law is do this or this will happen to you when you boil it down. So the or, well, this is what will happen to you is what he's talking about. The judgment if you mess it up. Exodus 32:15. This is how I got convinced that this is probably a reference to the whole law. This is where it specifically says it was written on both sides. Then Moses turned and went down from the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand, tablets that were written on both sides, on the front side and on the back side they were written. That front and back imagery is what led me to believe, okay, these are linked. And when you look at the things that are they're spoken against, middle on either side, reference the whole law. I think that's pretty solid. That's the sixth vision, trekking along. Seventh vision, I think, is the most interesting. Maybe after the fourth one with Joshua and his clean clothes. This one is a woman in a basket. Pretty quick little vision. Leah, you want to read this one for me? Chapter 5, verses 5 through 11?
So many verses. Yeah.
Okay.
Can I open up my room?
I was just on.
Alright.
Chapter 5, minus.
Hold on a second.
Oh, okay.
Again, I lifted my eyes and saw, and behold, four chariots came out from between two mountains.
Chapter 5, verses 5 through 11.
Sorry. Then the angel who talked with me came forward and said to me, lift your eyes and see what this is and what is going out. And I said, what is it? He said, this is the basket that is going out. And he said, this is the iniquity in all of the land. And behold, the land cover was lifted, and there was a woman sitting in the basket. Exclamation point. And he said, This is wickedness. And he thrust her back into the basket and thrust down the lid and weight on its opening. Then I lifted my eyes and saw, and behold, two women coming forward. The wind was on their wings. They had wings like the wings of a stork. They lifted up the basket between the earth and the heaven. When I said to the angel who talked with me, where are they taking the basket? He said, to the land of Shinar.
Yeah.
To the land of Shinar to build a house for it. And when this is prepared, they will set the basket down there on its face.
Okay. There's a lot in this one that you could spend a lot of time digging into. first of all, let's make sure we get the picture right. So what does he see first?
A basket.
A basket. What's in it?
A woman.
A woman. What's on top of it?
A lead cover.
A lead cover. I just translated it, weighted cover. The point, it's a cover that's made of lead. It's really heavy. A leaden cover. And then what happens to the basket?
Two stork women fly away with it.
Two stork women fly away with it. Well summarized. I liked this picture summarizing this.
So were the LXX and Syriac and the MT all trans?
The LXX is the Greek testament of Old Testament. The Greek translation of Old Testament Bible. The generally agreed upon Greek translation. Syriac would be the Syriac translation of Old Testament text. The MT would be the Masoretic text. That'd be the oldest Hebrew text that we have.
So that says I instead of an Greek.
Okay.
And my red. And it is the I throughout all the earth. This is their I throughout all the earth.
Is there a point in?
And then the LXX and the Syriac red, the iniquity.
Yeah, I do have a note on here to talk about that. I believe I do. We'll get to that. Yes.
It says
ephah instead of basket. Good. This is the ephah going out. An ephah is a measurement unit of wheat. The reason.
Why would they be using that basket? Just like a measurement.
Good question. I don't know. The reason we usually translate a basket because later it becomes clear that she's sitting in the ephah and it's got a cover on it.
So it's saying she's sitting in wheat, or is she just sitting in?
She's sitting in the container that you would normally use to carry an ephah. So like ephah, like a measurement unit, the same way we said like a gallon, right? So she's sitting in a gallon. Okay, do we mean like a gallon of something, or are we talking about like a container that is a gallon big? You with me?
Yeah.
So ephah is the measurement unit that we normally use. So that's why most of them will say basket, because you'd be carrying an ephah of wheat in a basket that is the size of an ephah. That's why most English translations will say basket. But literally, this is the ephah. Think of it like this is the 20 gallons going out. This is their iniquity, literally, I. Most reliable translations say I, like E-Y-E. This is the sight going out. Why then do we translate it iniquity? Because a little bit later, and behold, the leaden cover was lifted, a woman was sitting on it, and he said, what does he say? This is wickedness. This is evil. So, how does I relate to wickedness? Well, it's what you see, the evil that you're seeing, the iniquity. And then a couple of translations, or a couple of early manuscripts, made that jump themselves. Like they were copying it, they said, this is the I, they read a little bit later, wickedness, oh, okay. We're talking about iniquity. This is the evil that I see. That's why you have some variation in the manuscripts. This would be a textual criticism problem. We've talked about textual criticism in here before, right? When scribes are copying down the text and there's variation, how do we account for it? This one, I think, is pretty easy to deal with. It's probably the original said I, E-Y-E, and then the scribe said, as they were copying, well, what does that really mean? Okay, iniquity. It's the wickedness that he sees.
So instead of letting people decide for themselves what it means,
they went ahead and helped you out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mine actually has a footnote that says instead of, like, for iniquity, it has appearance.
Yeah, I. Same word. And that's why I put ESV, rather. I rarely put what translation I'm putting up on the screen unless there's a particular TC issue like that. Point is, what's in the basket? A woman who has personified wickedness, evil, sin, iniquity. She's in the basket, and two women show up. And they had wings like a stork. Now, who are these women? What do you think?
Women with wings of stork.
Okay, we're aware of the vision, yes? Now let's try and understand the interpretive meaning of the vision.
Stork from the book, Are You My Mother?
I'm going to go with a no on that one.
Okay.
That would be poor hermeneutics.
It's Jesus.
They're taking the
okay, let's put the who are these women on hold. What are they doing?
They're taking the wickedness of the world.
They're taking wickedness, the woman in the basket, with the leaden cover keeping her from sight. To where?
Babylon,
Shinar. Shinar is very very prevalent throughout this whole story. If you do a word search on Shinar, you find it all the way back in early chapters of Genesis as the sort of center of wickedness and evil. And if we go to Revelation, this is where 16 is, I think. No, 18. Getting all my chapters mixed up. 17 and 18. Chapter 17 and 18 of Revelation. What do your headings say in chapter 17 of Revelation?
I do not have headings.
The woman on the beast.
The woman on the beast. The great prostitute.
I thought you said the woman on the yeast.
I'm going to start reading 17. Tell me if this sounds familiar.
Babylon is destroyed and the great prostitute and the beast.
Babylon is destroying the great prostitute and the beast. So this is chapter 17 of Revelation. Then one of the seven angels with the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality, and with the wine of whose sexual immorality and dwellers on the earth are drunk. He carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had seven heads and ten horns, and the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with pearls, and on her forehead was written the name of a mystery, Shinar the Great. Babylon the Great. Same place. Mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations, or iniquities.
So one of the women with the stork wings left, and one of them is still sitting on the basket. It seems like those two are connected, because it's all the wickedness that she's sitting on, and it's covered. I don't know. Whatever.
There's three women total in the vision.
There's one in the basket and two...
There's one in the basket, yeah. And then two women with wings come up and take her away to Shinar. So I'm saying the woman in the basket is the same woman who's on the beast in chapter 17. Babylon, Shinar. And then chapter 18 is the fall of Babylon. After this, I saw another angel. He called out with a mighty voice, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She, Babylon, has become a dwelling place for demons, and a haunt for every unclean spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird, and every unclean detestable beast, and for all the nations have drunk in the wine and the passions of her sexual immorality. The kings have committed immorality with her." So I'm saying this is there's a link here. I don't quite understand the link, but there's a clear link between the woman of wickedness, who is taken off to Babylon, and then the woman of iniquity and abominations, who is riding the beast, whose name is Babylon. The woman's name is Babylon, I should say.
So basically, they're taking Babylon to Babylon.
Yeah, they're taking they're taking wickedness off to Babylon to where it belongs, covering it up and taking it off to Babylon. I would say for the appointed time. I think what's going on. So. Going to get into the speculation era. So, take this for what it's worth. Yeah.
What's a stork?
What's a stork?
A bird.
It's a type of bird.
You know the ones that carry babies? Storks?
Oh.
Those are storks.
I'm sorry, okay.
Lunko!
I was like.
Okay. Oh, goodness gracious. Okay, so.
I think what's happening here is we've got the wickedness of Israel that is being, he's instructing him to put it away until the appointed time, at which point she will be released and destroyed. All wickedness will be done away with, sort of thing, and the day of the Lord. So it's like this instruction to like the wings that are swift like a stork's, get it out of here, put it away until its time is due. Something along those lines. Genesis 11 is when Shinar first kind of pops up on the scene. And as I said, whenever you're trying to interpret difficult visions, start turning left.
Right.
Whatever pops up, and it's like, see if this has come around before. That'll help you interpret where it is now. Genesis 11 is where Shinar first shows up, and it's the Tower of Babel, the center of iniquity. This is where Babylon starts getting its claim to infamy. I wish that infamy sounded like fame when you say it, so it would ring better. Everybody kind of with me on what's going on there? I don't understand the women. Because if these are angels, this would be the first and only time you see female angels. Which I'm not saying that can't happen, but it raises some questions with classically understood angelology. If they're not angels, then who the heck are they? Are they representative of someone who is taking the wickedness away?
And is there any significance of there being stork wings? Why not?
Good questions.
Eagle's wings. Eagle's wings are referred to.
Exactly. And you're thinking correctly. You want to, if it gives you detail in the vision, ask, is this detail important and what does it mean? And once you do your due diligence, and I didn't do this, but I would say search the Bible for every use of the word stork. See if something else comes through that makes it clear. Or Israelite culture. I think that would be your last line of defense of understanding this. Always start with the text first. If there's something else in the text that helps to clarify the meaning, that gets precedence, because this is one unified story telling you
this is a prophet.
What it means.
He's not speaking to anyone, is he? Is Zechariah speaking to someone about these visions?
Yeah, he's writing them down. And telling them to the nation. All of these are supposed to be giving them hope for a future. Right? We're rebuilding the temple. We're reestablishing life in Jerusalem. We're trying to get everybody back on track with the law of the Lord, following the sacrificial system, looking for the Messiah. And so he's giving you pictures of the future, letting you know what's going to come so that you'll be ready and you'll be on the lookout for the Messiah. You'll be on the lookout for the coming of the Lord. That's kind of the point of all of these visions when you get boiled down. That's why he's giving them. Yep.
So this is whenever I first reading about the woman with the covered over with the heavy covering, mm-hmm. or whatever, it reminded me of Pandora's box.
Interesting.
You know, you open it up and all this evil and all this nastiness comes out.
Yeah.
It reminded me of that.
I say,
even
I agree with the imagery.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think that's what they're thinking of, but I agree with the imagery. Yeah, that's a good connection. You're thinking well. And you guys are asking the right questions. I'm asking the same questions. Like I said, Zechariah is one of those books where a whole lot of the time that I'm teaching, I'm just going, don't know. I know that's what it says. We can get a clear picture of what it says. And if you come up with ideas, let me know, because I want to know what they mean. I'm still working on it myself.
One day we'll know.
Exactly. This is the last vision. Four chariots. Again, chapter 6, verse 1. Read along with me. Again. I lifted up my eyes, and I saw, and behold, four chariots came out from between two mountains. And the mountains were mountains of bronze. And the first chariot had red horses, the second black horses, the third white horses, and the fourth dapple, or speckled horses. All of them strong. Or, another translation, completely legitimate, all four of the dappled horses were strong. So, just the last chariot is the one with the strong horses. Verse 4, then I answered and said to the angel who talked with me, what are these, my lord? And the angel answered and said to me, these are going out to the four winds of heaven, after presenting themselves before the Lord of all the earth. The chariot with the black horses goes towards the north country, and the white ones go after them, and the dappled ones go toward the south country. Now when the strong horses came out, they were impatient to go and patrol the earth. And he said, go, patrol the earth. So they patrolled the earth. Then he cried to me, behold, those who go toward the north country have set my spirit at rest in the north country. We'll pause right there. So let's get a sense of what the vision is. What does he see?
Mountains of bronze.
Mountains of bronze, two of them. Four chariots coming out from in between them.
Black, white, speckled horses.
Red, black, white, speckled horses. Either all of them with strong horses or just the speckled horses are strong. And what are these horses doing?
Two runs
going out
north.
We'll get that in a second.
One to the south. And then the speckled horses go and they roam the earth.
I thought they all roamed the earth.
Here, what? Start back. You kind
of. It was the black and the white go north.
There you go. Two of them go to the north.
Yeah.
One goes to the south.
Goes south. And the speckled horses roam the earth. They.
The speckled ones go to the south.
Speckled ones.
He didn't say where the red ones go.
It said the strong ones were restless or something like that.
Right. So the question is, are this
to
when it
roam the earth?
In verse 7, when it says the strong horses came out and were impatient to go around the earth, is that referring just to the speckled ones or to all of them? All of them are impatient to go out to the earth, both north, south, etc.
Mine says bay.
All these strong ones are scattering. They have sought
spell bay.
B A Y.
Like the bay is a color of horse.
Okay.
Yeah. It's like a cherry brown with a black vein, typically.
And that's verse 7?
It says bay instead of.
Dappled or speckled?
Yeah, as well.
That's
in verse 3.
In verse 7, what does it say?
Bay.
The bay horses came out and were impatient to go forth across the earth.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it says all these strong ones are scattering. They have sought permission to go and walk over the earth. The Lord had said, go and walk over the earth. So it was like they'd gotten permission and then they went to the north and south.
Yes. So it's still it's a question of, are the strong ones referring to just the last chariot? Or to all of the horses.
Does it matter whether it says they were all strong or the strong and dappled horses?
Sorry? Your translators are going to pick one of those two interpretations.
So it means the same thing?
No, it means two different things. Either we're saying that just the dappled horses or the bay horses are strong. And so that what changes is your interpretation of verse 7. Because quite literally verse 7... says when the strong horses, I believe it says.
Yeah, when the strong horses came out, they were impatient to go and control the earth. But mine, it doesn't refer back, but if you read chapter 3, at least, not chapter 3, verse 3, verse 2, starting out, the first chariot had red horses, the second black, the third white, and the fourth dappled, all of them powerful.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yes, it could be just the dappled, but
correct.
I would think they're powerful.
Both translations are legitimate. It's a question of the phrase, they powerful.
Mm-hmm.
I can give you a very literal translation.
Yours says strong, dappled horses, and mine say all of them powerful.
The chariot be'eth of the fourth with the horses Barodim dappled strong, plural. The word is just strong left there on the end of the sentence. So the question is, does this apply to just the last noun or to all of the nouns that were plural in the sentence? Is this modifier dangling or direct. I think it's just the last chariot. The dappled horses are the strong ones. And that's what most of your translations will say. We'll pick up on that particular interpretation. which is why in chapter 7, the King James translator just went ahead and said, it's the dabble horses, the strong ones. Whereas some of the other translations will be like, oh, we're not sure, we think all of them are strong, so we're just going to say the strong horses. That's literally what the word is in verse 7, the strong horses. Everybody with me? This is a minor point. Not key to the interpretation of the whole passage, but so we're clear on the two options here. This is why Zechariah is a hard book. So we got two mountains, four chariots with teams of horses coming out from between them. Let's get back into this. I liked this picture that I found of it. Yeah, you got the mountains, and you got the dappled, the black, the red, and the white. The white or the black and the white go off to the north. The dappled go to the south.
Actually.
Yep.
I do have a footnote that says follow behind them, but the first translation or whatever, it says the white horses toward the west. And then it has a footnote and it says, or horses after them, instead of toward the west.
Sorry, guys.
I don't know. I'm just saying that just because, just for...
No,
I'm not arguing anything. I'm just saying just for reference or whatever.
Yeah, so we know what...
And that picture shows them that the white and the black are going different directions, if you look at the way they're facing.
Yeah, I think that's just them coming out of the mountain. Let me see. What verse is that, sorry?
Six.
And those, them, the white horses, or excuse me, the horses, the Hashurim, the black, Yetzim, Al Ha'alex, and the black ones went off for the earth, Tzafon, north of the earth. Bahalavim, white. Yahu, go, al, harochem, them. I have no idea where they're getting the west from.
Yeah, me either. I just thought. West on that one.
Yeah, no clue where they're getting the west from.
All
right. Actually, let me flip back. Maybe does this remind you of anything? Side. These horses going out and patrolling the earth.
Much like the other horses.
Much like the first vision that he got of horse. Well, not even that. Flip back to chapter 1 of Zechariah.
The red, the white.
Right?
You there had, were only three types of horses.
There were three types of horses. They were doing the same thing, though, right? They were going up patrolling the whole earth.
Are you talking about the four horns? No,
four horses.
One.
I'm reading
so. Chapter 1, starting in verse 7, focusing on verse 8. I saw a man riding on a red horse. He was standing among the myrtle trees, and behind him were red sorrel and white horses. And he said, "Who are these?" And the man said, standing among the myrtle trees, said, "These are those whom the Lord has sent to patrol the earth." The angel of the Lord was standing among the myrtle trees and said, "We have patrolled the whole earth, and behold, all the earth remains at rest. The Lord of hosts, how long will you have no mercy on Jerusalem and the cities of Judah?" So these are very similar visions. Slight differences. More horses, chariots this time, and
mountains of bronze.
Again, with a vision like this, you're asking yourself, what are the details? Why do they give us those details? Is there a clear reference that these details are pointing to? The only ones that I've gotten any kind of clarity on are the mountains of bronze. I think the mountains of bronze refers to the Mount of Olives, which Christ will split when he returns. I get that from, first of all, chapter 14, verses 3 through 4 of Zechariah, which we'll get to when we get to chapter 14, obviously, but real quick. Then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations as he fights on a day of battle, and on that day his feet shall stand on the Mount of Olives that lies before Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives shall be split in two from east to west by a very wide valley, so that one half of the mountain shall move northward and the other one southward.
Where are you reading this from?
Zechariah chapter 14.
14:3-4.
So, in the Messianic prophecies at the end of Zechariah, pretty clearly saying that the Messiah is going to stand on the Mount of Olives, it's going to split. I'm pretty sure that's what the two mountains of bronze are. Hence, it's split into the east and the west, and so the horses are going north and south from the mountains. North, pretty much always a reference to Israel, scattered nations, right? Northern tribes. So, let's think of that as we're reading this again. They went to the north. What time is it? Oh, we're already over time. We'll finish this up quick. Forms of heaven presenting themselves to all the Lord. They went to the north. The strong horses went out, were impatient to go. Go patrol the earth. And he cried, "Behold, those who go to the north country have set my spirit at rest in the north country." What does that mean?
They did their job.
Sorry?
They did their job. They went forth and did what they needed to?
Yes. Expand. What do you mean?
Well, I don't know. I just offered an opinion.
Okay, so what's in the north? What's the deal with Israel right now? Where?
Maybe they brought together the tribes.
There you go.
They reunited them.
Right? At this point in time, the northern tribes are scattered by Assyria. They don't exist. They still don't in current 21st century days. So the two who are patrolling the north country are, I think, regathering the tribes.
One to the south.
Think, again, there's a whole lot of parallels between Zechariah and Revelation. You go to Revelation chapter 7. I saw four angels standing at four quarters of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth. We already saw four winds of the earth in this passage of Zechariah. No wind would blow on the sea or against the angel ascending from the rising sun. He called out with a loud voice. The angels have been given power to harm the earth, or the sea. Or those whom we have sealed on our sealed the servant until we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads. And I heard the number who was sealed, 144,000, sealed from every tribe of the sons of Israel, 12,000 from Judah, from Reuben, Gad, Asher, Naphtali, Manasseh, Simeon, Levi. These 12 tribes, those of the north included, they get sealed. I believe this is a reference to the same event. During tribulation, when the northern tribes will be reclaimed, sealed, and preserved through the tribulation period. Hence, setting my spirit at rest. My people, whom I promised to give a land and a hope, they've been taken care of. They will make it there and see the fulfillment of this promise. That's where I'm going with that, at least. Direction I'm headed. All right, so we got through the eight symbolic visions. We will finish off chapter 8 next week and hopefully get through the four explanatory messages. So handout 2 we will actually use next week.